Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This is episode 784. We recorded it on July 3rd, 2011, and aired it on the Premier Radio Networks. Now you get to watch it in all its splendor on TWiT. Thanks for joining me. Enjoy. The podcast edition of the Tech Guy Radio Show is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Happy Independence Day. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, Independence Day Eve. It's Independence Day weekend, all weekend long. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And this is the show where... I'm sorry if you tuned in here by accident. This is a show where we just talk about geek stuff, but in a non-geeky way so you can understand it. How about that? Does that make it better? Computers and the internet, sure, but really also, in fact, somewhat more interestingly, cell phones and home theater. All the digital devices that are in our lives now, and they're really changing everything. The way we work, the way we play, the way we interact, even the way we search. I wasn't going to talk about Google Plus today. I really wasn't, but they can't help it. Google has, in the tech world, they call it a pivot. Google has pivoted. I think this is bigger than just another Google thing, another Google program, or like Wave or Buzz, or Google's always introducing new stuff. No, this is bigger than that. In fact, the head management at Google is even intimated that this is a reinvention, a make or break of Google. If you go to google.com, I think this is true for everybody. There's now a black bar at the top with Google. What was always there, the Google, different Google programs, Gmail, News, Maps, Video, Images, all of that. The More button is still there. But for some of us, and I think even some people now in public, because this has been a closed beta, but it started, was it Thursday? Seems like it's been longer than that. On the very far left, there's a little plus sign with your name. This is something Google rolled out. They're calling it, they're not calling it a beta, actually. They're calling it more like a test. But it is a new social network from Google that is in some ways variation, an attack on Facebook and Twitter and all the other social networks. See, Google really has been, up until now, a plain old search engine. It indexes the web. You enter in your search terms. It looks through its index. It finds what you're looking for, gives you a list of things that match the terms. The key secret sauce to Google was how it ordered that list. They call it PageRank after Larry Page, one of the founders. And they have a semi-secret algorithm that figures out that this is what you must have been looking for and putting that first. And then, that wasn't it. The next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And they do a good job. That's why Google has become the dominant search engine. Somewhere, I think, 60 or 70% of all searches go through Google. Not 90, not 100. 60 or 70%. Microsoft Bing is number two, and then there's a bunch of also-rans. But Google recently has noticed, I think, that the search alone is not enough. People want more. It's not the searching. Google still does that very well. It's the ranking, isn't it? It's, if you search for a restaurant, it's one thing to rank highly the restaurant that has the highest page rank and the most other restaurants linked to and stuff. But that's not that useful. If you're searching for a restaurant, the first thing Google, and they've done this for a while, does is say, well, you're in Los Angeles, so let's show you restaurants in Los Angeles first. That makes sense, right? Well, now I think what they're going for is to add information about what your friends think of these restaurants, what they like. And the higher ranked restaurants will be the ones that have the approval of your friends. Now, how do they do that? Well, Facebook can do it, can't they? Because they know that. That's why Facebook and Microsoft have made a deal with the Bing search engine. If you do Bing searches, you'll see results based. There's a little box that says your Facebook friends said. Google, I'm sure, is looking at that a little jealously. So they've created this thing called Google Plus, but it's more than just, you know, a Facebook clone. It's got a number of pieces. There's what they call the stream, which is the same thing as the Facebook wall. You get, oh, it's kind of a little Twitterish too. You get to choose who you follow. Unlike Facebook, though, you can be followed by people you don't follow. That's more like Twitter. It's what we call an asymmetric relationship. You choose who you see in your stream, but other people can choose you without you reacting. In fact, there's a little button on the Google stream that says incoming. These are people who are following you, but you aren't following. But you can also narrow the stream down. You could say, well, I only want to see what my friends are saying, or my family, or my family is blank. My family does not do the internet, really. Even the kids, they kind of do the internet. They're really still Facebooking. In fact, Henry, my 17-year-old, almost 17-year-old son, really just got off MySpace. It's kind of interesting to see who is on Google Plus right now. It's a mix, including Tom, who founded MySpace, and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. They're on here. But it's invitation only. That's why I was kind of hesitant to talk too much about it, because you know a lot of people can't get into this yet. It will open soon, I think. So you narrow down your circles. I can say, for instance, I just want to see people who are photographers, and I create this list in my stream, and then I'll see just a bunch of beautiful photographs and posts from photographers, which is kind of fun. You can also comment. Unlike Twitter, the comments are right underneath the original post, so you can kind of you could follow a conversation much more easily. I think that's interesting. And like Facebook, instead of the like button, they have a plus one button. Plus one is the same thing as a Facebook like. It's a thumbs up. They also, but that's not all. There's more. The circles I mentioned are a way of organizing your friends. It's very powerful. It lets you really in a very powerful way that Twitter kind of allows with lists, Facebook kind of allows with groups, but in a much more elegant and intuitive way does this organizational thing. But that's not all. There's also photo sharing. If you have an Android phone, and soon an iPhone, you'll be able to automatically upload it. Right now, it automatically uploads all my Android phone pictures. Privately, not publicly, but it makes it very easy for me to share them. Look, Newt Gingrich is sharing his pictures on here. Yeah, the politicians have found it already. It's very interesting. There's also a very powerful feature that nobody has right now called Hangout, which allows you to create a room, a video room, with you and up to 9 of your other friends where you chat together. I think the Hangout is very powerful because it's very natural. I could see a lot of people using this just to kind of at work, for having, you know, work groups kind of communicate with one another. Because every computer has a camera and a microphone nowadays, right? It's a very natural thing. In fact, interesting, because as soon as Google Plus came out, Mark Zuckerberg, almost the same day, said, oh, yeah, we got a big announcement too. Oh, yeah. We're going to announce something on Monday. No, actually, because it's Wednesday. They're having a big event Wednesday morning. And it's pretty clear, according to the leaks, that they're going to announce something very much like this Hangout thing. They'll use Skype, but there will be a... And I've been wondering, as soon as Microsoft announced that it was going to buy Skype, I thought, this is something that makes sense. Microsoft, remember, is a small, not a majority, but a minority stakeholder in Facebook. They own a good chunk of it, though, I think 5%, something like that. Makes perfect sense. They bought Skype. I couldn't figure out why, for $8.5 billion, Microsoft even wanted Skype. Maybe they wanted it for their friends at Facebook. So now that's going to be powerful, I think. And that's why I like this. And this is really the main reason I'm talking about it. Well, there's two reasons. One, because I think what we're seeing is a complete shift in the way Google thinks about the internet. This isn't just another Google feature. This is going to be tightly integrated into their search. It's a way for them to get social information into the search. It's information about what your friends like, who your friends are. And I think that's very powerful. And it's something we want, to be honest. It really is less mechanical and a more personal form of search. But also, I think, very important for Google, it's a chance for them to reinvent themselves. It's very interesting. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our good friends at Netflix, of course, you know about. I don't have to tell you about Netflix. You know about Netflix, don't you? It's that great DVD by mail system where you you make a list of all the movies that you want to see, and you get them. You get one to eight at a time, and you watch them, and then you send them back. There's no late fees. I really like that. But Netflix also has, and I really want to tell you about this. If you haven't tried it, it's so cool. This Watch Instantly feature. Have you used this? I use it. I used it again last night. I use it almost all the time. Watch Instantly lets you on your Roku box. How often do I watch movies with strong women? Pretty much often. Thanks for sharing. See, they're always looking for recommendations. We watched A Paper Chase the other night. That was a great movie. Here's their recommendations. These are all movies I can watch instantly on my iPad, my iPhone. I don't watch them so much on the portable devices, but it's great if you travel or you're stuck in a hotel room to be able to watch this stuff. But also, if you have an Xbox 360. Oh, Dollhouse is on now. They've got TV shows. Oh, I didn't mean to start it. I should probably pay attention to the show and not watch TV right now. But that's the beauty of it. You could watch it on your Xbox 360. Oh, let's not update right now. Let's go back to browsing. On your PlayStation 3, on your Nintendo Wii. Yeah, isn't that great? I guess they made a deal with Paramount. All the Star Trek shows, the original series plus the Next Generation, are on here as well. If you want to watch TV, that's very exciting. I use a Roku box to do this, so I'm always. There's Glee, Mad Men. It's just amazing that. So let's see. If I do search for Star Trek. Here's what happens. You go here, and when you see play, that means it's in the Watch Instantly. So the movies are on here. Here's the original Star Trek. Let's add this to my instant queue for sure. And then, by the way, it suggests all these other great shows you might like, TV shows. So that's excellent. Why does it say new episodes? There hasn't been a new episode since 1967. TNG, Voyager, Enterprise. This is awesome. All right, I want you to try it free for 30 days. Netflix.com/twit. If you are already a member, do me a favor. Tell your friends. Netflix.com/twit. And this is new. This is something exciting. They've agreed to support the radio show. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. We want to talk to you about tech. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll be talking with Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru, about home theater. We were talking in the break about the fact that Netflix now has a Star Trek, the original series from 1966 on its streaming. And I had forgotten, but Scott Wilkinson had been raving about this. He said, oh, you got to get the Blu-ray. I said, the Blu-ray? What are you talking about? Of Star Trek? Who wants the Blu-ray of a show, a TV show from 1966? He says, no. Because remember, all these TV shows, yeah, they were broadcast in standard definition. When you watch them on TV now, which you're not seeing a high-def version of Star Trek. You're seeing the original standard definition. But all these shows were shot in those days, in the mid-60s, on film. And film is high-def. I mean, it's 4x3, but it's not, you know, so it's not widescreen, but there is enough, you know, if you've got the negatives, if you've got the original film, you can make a high def DVD out of it, or in this case, a Blu-ray DVD. And that's exactly what they did. Plus, they went back and they replaced a lot of the original special effects, what we call the computer generated graphics, the CGI, with modern CGI. And this is funny, John, my studio manager, just told me, because he's a big Star Trek fan. I didn't know this, but I forgot there were analog clocks in the original Star Trek series. They were rolling clocks, like the flip clocks. They would roll. And I guess Nixie tubes or something, right? No? Not even Nixie tubes? Anyway, they've somehow, like, cut them out of the film and put real digital clocks in there. Like an they were like odometers. Right. And now, which is analog, of course, and now they've replaced those with true digital clocks. I like that. In fact, you're right. It wasn't CGI. Specie 8470 in our chat room is saying, no, no, Leo, it wasn't CGI in the original series. It was models. It was little plastic models they'd shoot with cameras. Well, even Star Wars, the original Star Wars, was models. But now we can do it all on a computer, and it looks even better. And so I hear it's wonderful. I haven't watched it yet. We will be talking in just a bit with our friend Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guru. If you've got a home theater question, 888-ASK-LEO. In fact, I didn't mention that's the phone number if you want to participate in the show. 888-ASK-LEO, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. Outside the U.S., you can call that via Skype app. Now, I know it's hard to remember that, and I know I say it fast. So let me give you something that's easier to remember that you should remember, which is techguylabs.com. You got that? Techguylabs.com. That's where not only the phone number is, but also a link to our great chat room. They're fun. A link to show notes from all of our previous episodes. This is episode 784, so there's a lot there. And you can search for it if you want to know what I thought about, you know, Apple moving to Intel. You can find that. It's historic stuff going back to 2004. It's all there online, including audio from all the previous shows, and in many cases, video as well, and our live video. So, you know, nothing more exciting than watching a guy do a radio show. But you can also do that. It's also available at techguylabs.com, plus the phone number and the chat room. We're building a new studio, actually. The Tech Guy Labs are moving, and probably, I'm hoping, 3 weeks from today. That's our plan. And July 24th, I'm planning to take my ball, the exercise ball I do this show. I don't sit in a big chair. I sit on a ball. I don't know why. It feels more energetic. But I'm going to pick up my ball and watch. I'm going to march down the street. We went to the local, the small town. I do this show from Petaluma, California, small town, about 50,000 people. We went to the police department and said, do we need a permit? Because I want to have a little mini parade of me and my staff as we move what's left of the Tech Guy Labs down the street two blocks. And they said, no, just stay on the sidewalk and obey traffic laws. I said, okay. So I'm going to carry my ball. John, will you'll carry, you know, a few computers, my headphones, things like that. And we'll go down to this beautiful new studio we've been building since January. $1 million facility, 10,000 square feet. Yes, all just for me. What? You got a problem with that? I need to spread out. Actually, one of the things we're going to add to the labs, I'm really excited about this. One of the, I do besides this radio show, the reason we need so much space is we actually do about 25 shows. We're moving to 24/7, full-time operation, like kind of a CNN for geeks of just tech stuff all the time. And one of the shows we do it every, when do we do Ham Nation? What day of the week? Wednesday? Tuesday at 6. Tuesday at 6 Pacific. That's when we would do it. Bob Heil, who is an old ham for many, many years, one of the best-known hams out there because he makes ham radio microphones, hosts the show. And along with Gordo, his sidekick, who is also a very well-known ham, called Ham Nation. And they've convinced me. Gordo does ham training. They've convinced me to become a ham. So one of the things, and I have 3 weeks to do it, by the way. Did you know that? I have to get my license by the time we move so we can get a call sign. There's a call sign I want, a vanity call sign. So we're going to, I hope I can take the test and pass and get that technician license, and we're going to build a little ham radio facility as part of the corner of the studio. Yeah. It's not unusual for radio guys to be hams. I didn't know this. Bob wants to get access to the roof so he could put up a 10-meter and a 50-meter antenna. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we're definitely going to have to get a permit for that. Anyway, that there are a lot of radio guys. I, of course, best known probably Art Bell, who would do his show coast to coast from his double wide in Pahrump. And then after the you would think that would be enough, you know, 4 hours, middle of the night. You'd think that, or what was it, 5 hours? Every night, you would think that would be enough. But no, he would then, after the show was over, go down to his hammering rig and start broadcasting and do more. There's some, I guess, people who do radio like radio or something like that. But I think it's been something that I've wanted to do for a while, not merely because I think it'd be a fun hobby, mostly because I want to. I think the ham community is very interesting, kind of little appreciated, but very important to what we are doing with technology today. They've invented it in their own community, invented many of the technologies we use today, but also because in emergencies, they're incredibly important to the community. And all you have to do is look to Katrina, the recent hurricanes and tornadoes, earthquakes, and when everything else falls apart, the hams are there for emergency communications, and they're often the lifeline for a lot of people. It was so true during Katrina. So I think that that's important, too. So I'm excited by that. So I'll have my call letters in a few weeks. Maybe not three. I'll take the test within 3 weeks. I'll have the call letters in 4 or 5 weeks, and I'll let you know what they are, and we can have some fun. The test is not hard. You don't have to do dot, 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 dash, dash, dash anymore. All right, I'm going to get Scott Wilkinson on the line. We're going to do some home theater stuff. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. Terry H. in our chat room says, if you build a ham shack, make sure it's a Smithfield ham. No, it's not that. 8888-ASK-LEO, this phone number. Scott Wilkinson joins us. We'll talk home theater in just a little bit. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And that's got to be you, Scott Wilkinson, on the mini bagpipe or whatever that is.
Well, it's a recorder ensemble, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it's the group that plays at the Renaissance Fair every year, and I played with them for many years.
See you prancing around in tights. For some reason, I don't know why.
I did it for many, many years.
See, I knew it, guys. Scott is wearing his red, white, and blue shirt. I can tell because he's on Skype today, and that looks good. Happy Independence Day, Scott.
Happy Heir of Independence Day.
Independence Day.
It's the Jewish way of saying the day before.
Ah, yes, it's Eve, isn't it?
Yes,
but exactly. I consider it a 3-day weekend.
Yes, I
started my potato salad yesterday.
Very good. We're going to go see some fireworks tomorrow. Burbank, here where I live, has some great fireworks.
We played that Star Trek, or I should say Kyle Benham, who is always looking
for... That was amazing.
You know why he played that?
Tell me.
We were talking about Star Trek, the original series, and you were the one who said, oh, you got to get the Blu-ray, and I mocked you. I laughed. And now it's on Netflix streaming, and everybody's getting so excited because it looks so good. I guess they had the film, and they digitized the film, so it is high. It's 4x3.
Yes, it's 4x3, but it is high definition because they took the original film and they rescanned it. They rescanned it probably at 4K, even higher resolution than high definition.
So any TV show that was made on film,
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm.
If they save the negatives, you could have high def versions of Ginger and Marianne.
Hey, wouldn't that be great?
Woo woo! No, but I Love Lucy was the first TV show to get kinescoped. I think that they, in fact, pioneered the kinescope process for that show.
They also pioneered 3-camera shoots.
Yeah. So that might be the cutoff. Anything before that, you're not going to have, but there could be.
That may be.
I would love to see them, for instance, old Johnny Carson shows.
Wouldn't that be great?
There's a lot of stuff that's around on the film stock that they could, if there were interest, put on Blu-ray. But we were talking about Netflix. I'm just really pleased that you don't even have to get the Blu-ray now. You can watch the stream in high def. It's not as high quality as the Blu-ray.
It's not quite as high quality as Blu-ray, but yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, I think earlier, they also redid all of the what were at the time called opticals. So the shots of the little model spaceships and the planets, which if you remember on the original series, they all looked very fuzzy.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have much contrast or anything to them. There was either a pink planet or a blue planet, and there wasn't much to them. But now all the planets have real features, you know, continents and oceans and clouds and stuff. And the ships all look great, too.
That's
so they replaced all of that with digital.
But did you hear what John said? He noticed that in the original Star Trek series on TV, all the clocks were like odometers. They had mechanical wheels that turned.
Yes.
They replaced them with digital.
Can you imagine? That was
amazing. That's a lot of work. Somebody went through this like with Photoshop, frame by frame, and put a digital clock in there.
That's right. Well, you know, Star Trek has such a fanatical audience, including those who work in the industry.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it was a labor of love.
Well, that's the key. If nobody's going to do all this work if there's not a pretty good audience for the outcome, the final.
Exactly.
Product.
Yeah, exactly right.
So let's talk home theater. Scott is the editor-in-chief of the Ultimate AV Magazine, ultimateavmag.com. He's also a columnist at Home Theater Magazine, and he joins us every week about this time to talk about TV. I got my Orb system set up, by the way, with a 300-watt subwoofer.
Oh, great. How does
sounds
it sound?
Great. It's a stereo. This is for my new
channel.
Office.
Mm-hmm.
But now they do home theater, and I'm thinking, man.
They do.
Maybe I might get, you know, the center channel, the left, the right, the rear, the back, the center, the up, the down.
Uh-huh. Now, my colleague Tom Norton reminded me after that my appearance last week when we talked about the Orb a little bit, just to make sure that the Orb, the little satellite, goes down in frequency far enough so that it blends well with the subwoofer, or that, conversely, that the subwoofer goes up high enough. So again, that they blend together. There isn't like a hole in the low mid frequency range.
Now, when you hook it up to a stereo, an AV receiver, the AV receiver does what? That's called crossover, which frequencies,
correct,
which speakers handling.
Yeah.
And
yep,
it does it automatically. But now, because I'm using it with a computer, I'm using a powered subwoofer. It has a big old dial that says crossover frequency, and it goes
right
from very low to relatively high.
Yeah.
So I should play with that until I hear a good mid range, you think?
Correct.
Because right now it doesn't sound that way. I've got a boom, boom, boom,
right,
and I got a kind of a tinny high end.
Right.
There's also
You want to increase the crossover frequency. It probably goes up to like 120 hertz, something like
even
that.
Even higher, I think 180, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So yeah. I would play with that, but it'll probably end up somewhere in the upper range.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, it says in the manual there is a break-in period.
Mm-hmm.
There's a break-in period for speakers?
There is, absolutely. it takes a little while for the flexible parts, if you will, to kind of get stretched out a little bit and comfortable.
It's like a balloon.
Yeah, kind of.
Initially it's stiff, but you want it to be a little more fluid.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a break-in period for speakers. Also for plasmas. We've talked about that before.
Yeah. There's content that you would like to use to kind of break it in. They said, right, on the speakers, just use them. It doesn't really matter.
That is true, but that's primarily because if you use them, you're going to be exercising all of the frequencies.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
You're going to be listening to music, right?
Use to break in our plasma?
well, there's a couple of ways to do it. The easiest way is to simply watch mostly or all high-definition 16:9 content. You want the image to be moving. You don't want a static image. And you want it to fill the entire screen. So if you're watching a lot of 4:3, which has black bars on the sides, or you're watching a lot of movies, widescreen movies with black bars on the top and bottom, then you're not exercising the entire screen equally. So
all right, I get it. That
the thing
sense
to do is to tune in a high-def station and just watch 16:9 full-screen moving images. What we do in the studio when we're going to review a plasma is we put up a test pattern, which is a full field white, not 100% white, but like 50% white field that just covers the entire screen in the same color. That is 50% intensity white, which looks gray. And we just leave that up for 100 hours, like over the weekend and a little bit more. And then that exercises all of the pixels exactly equally.
Dr. Mom says it's somewhat similar to the process of breaking in a girdle. That makes sense.
Well, sure. A girdle's got to be flexible, I guess.
Yes.
Not that I have any.
And you probably know. Although William Shatner might. You probably don't want to do this with anything that has a bug on it, though, right? Because,
what do you mean?
Well, you know how CNN will have the CNN logo.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. You don't want to do it with and just keep it on that channel for 100 hours because that's true. That's a static element. That's a thing that just sits there.
Right.
And you really don't want that on there either. So, you can do it just by watching normal content and switching channels back and forth and trying to stay on 16:9 content as much as possible, and you'll be fine.
All right.
That's it.
Scott Wilkinson, what's your poll this week in the Ultimate AV Magazine?
My poll this week is, why has multi-channel music not been more popular? And I'm getting a lot of comments on it, too, which is great. You know, you've got you remember the formats SACD and DVD audio?
And surround sound, right? I
mean, surround sound for movies is very popular.
Right.
And people have home theaters with surround sound systems in them already. And yet,
you don't listen to audio that way.
We don't listen to music that way.
Yeah.
We don't listen to multi-channel music so much. SACD and DVD audio haven't been very successful. Blu-ray as a music format has not been very successful.
What you should do, go to ultimateavmag.com. Cast your vote. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. We will get to the phones in a moment. Scott Wilkinson is still with us, editor-in-chief of the Ultimate AV Magazine at ultimateavmag.com. We were talking about shows that were made on film. I don't know if Gilligan's Island was shot on film. I'm guessing it was.
I'm guessing it was, too.
But, of course, at some point, they started putting stuff on videotape, and that really isn't going to be great quality. You can't get high def out of videotape.
Well, not videotape that they use those days.
Right.
I mean, these days, of course, today they're using video, high def video.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And shooting in high def, so that's not a problem. But, yeah.
Well, as an example, Twilight Zone, which would be great to see in high def, only the first year was shot on film. After that, they switched to shooting on tape. And, you know, the other problem with tape is that in many cases, they erased the tape and reused it.
Yeah, just like NASA did for the original moon landing. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, they don't have the originals.
Right.
The first appearance of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. The first Super Bowl. No copy exists because it was videotaped. And they said, you know, the network said, well, no one will want to see this again. They were cheap. Let's reuse it. They can't reuse film. That's why that film exists in many cases.
Oh, man.
Apparently, according to iPhone Eric in our chat room, Gilligan's Island was shot on film and has already been transferred to high def.
Where can I get the Blu-ray?
I don't want it. I'm sorry. So I brought Scott back because of a couple of things. First of all, you were mentioning your current poll. He does a poll every week at Ultimate AV Magazine. Why isn't multi-channel music more popular? That's this week. But last week you asked, I thought, a really interesting question, and I was curious what the results of the poll were last week. You asked about digital versus analog. Can digital audio ever be as good as high-fidelity analog recordings?
And more specifically, can it be indistinguishable from?
Well, that's different. That's actually a different question.
It is.
And I made that distinction last week. You may not be able to, you may not think you can tell the difference, and I think that that's the case, but there may be a difference psychoacoustically.
Well, this was what I wanted to know because, you know, I think that a lot of audiophiles in particular believe that digital is always going to sound different from analog. And I'm not talking about vinyl LPs with their clicks and their pops and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about high quality analog where, I don't know, reel-to-reel tape maybe. I'm not quite sure what the medium would be. Because vinyl LPs are always going to have some mechanical problem. I was very surprised that 85% of the respondents said that, yes, digital audio can become indistinguishable from analog if the resolution is high enough. So CDs have a resolution of 44.1 kilohertz, that's the sampling rate, and 16 bits, which gives you a maximum dynamic range of something like 96 decibels. But you can increase that. Nowadays, high-resolution music is 96 kilohertz sampling rate and 24-bit resolution, which gives you 144, I think, decibels of dynamic range. I don't remember exactly. But in any event, you know, at some I've always wondered this. You know, at some point, there comes a point when the ear won't be able to discriminate any more resolution in digital audio because our ears are only finite in their
and
ability.
And yet, I think there is evidence that whether you can intellectually say, oh, I hear the difference, you may say, it sounds the same. And by the way, I've compared CD audio to MP3 audio, and at 192 kilobits, there was no way in an A-B comparison, blind A-B comparison, I could tell the difference.
Right.
That I could say reliably, oh, that's MP3, that's CD. And I'm sure it's the same with that's analog, that's digital. But there still may be and this is where it gets into psychoacoustics. There still may be an emotional reaction that's different. There may very well be a feeling that's different that we can't quantify.
Right, right. That may very well be.
I believe that there is.
I don't know that there have been any studies to demonstrate that.
I think it's purely theoretical. I've read some papers that claim that there is such a difference, but I don't know if they've been able to. It's hard to study because it's hard to verbalize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you can't say, that makes me feel better.
Right, right, right.
They have to do functional MRIs of the brain.
There you go. Let's commission a study.
See what parts of the brain light up when you listen to the
analog. Yeah, exactly right. Very good.
Yeah. So good. Well, ultimateavmag.com is the place. Now, you had a question, too, and I wanted to give you time to answer that.
I do. first of all, though, I want to let everybody know that I did a special episode of Home Theater Geeks podcast on Friday, because this Monday, of course, is 4th of July, so we're not going to do one then. And on that special edition, I didn't have a guest. Instead, I just chatted with the chat room.
You were the guest.
I was the guest. Well, the chat room was the guest, in a sense. I just answered questions from the chat room. I also gave a little video tour of my own home theater.
Oh, how fun.
So that should be up on twit.tv/HTG now.
Well, I got to watch that. I got to see what you have.
Also, at the end of the show, my wife came in and we sang Happy 4th of July to the chat room.
There's a song.
There is a song on that episode of Home Theater Geeks.
I mean, actually, somebody has written a song called Happy.
No. We sang Happy Birthday.
Oh, good. Now I'm going to get a bill from AOL Time Warner. You know they do that.
Ooh, I forgot about that. Ooh.
Oh yeah, thanks.
Sorry.
Don't sing it on the radio show. I don't want to get in trouble with the boss. No,
anyway.
That's true. I think people don't know that, but in fact, this is why very often in a movie, instead of singing Happy Birthday at a birthday scene, they'll sing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow or something like that. Because Time Warner, I think it was Chappelle Music, bought the rights from the two sisters who wrote Happy Birthday.
From the two sisters, yes.
Not even in the last century, in the 19th century, but somehow they managed to preserve the copyright. The publishing rights were purchased by Time Warner. And if you play Happy Birthday on a movie, a TV show, a podcast, you get a bill.
Oh, man. I'm really sorry I mentioned that on the air then.
No, actually, I'd be very curious if I get a bill. I think it'd be interesting.
Well, let me know.
I'll be glad to
maybe I'll have to pay it.
I'll pay it, but it'll, unless it's millions of dollars.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
I don't think that many people listen yet.
Yeah, probably not. Anyway, but it's my wife and me singing in harmony.
How nice.
So.
How nice. We'll look for that.
That's it.
Twit.tv/HTG. All right, we're going to get Scott's answer to one of your questions in just a second. All right, Scott, I'm going to give you 1 minute for the question and the answer.
The question and the answer. Ken Crayley, one of my loyal chat room followers, and thank you so much for that, asks, how has sound technology changed since I started in the home theater industry? Well, that's more than a minute's question, but I'll answer it quickly.
Yeah, no kidding. I can't give you the next hour for that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. basically, when I started, we were just getting into Dolby ProLogic or Dolby Surround, which was a simulated surround from two channels. So you had two channels, and then you had what's called a matrixing situation, which took the surround channels, the left and right surround channels, and mixed them in, kind of matrixed them in to the front left and right. And then the decoder kind of extracted them. But it wasn't – well, actually, there was only one. I'm sorry. There was only one surround channel.
This trip back in time will continue next week.
Yeah, very good. Sorry.
Scott Wilkinson, Ultimate AV Mag. We'll be back to the phones right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And yes, it's time to talk about technology. Computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number if you want to join in. And I know I didn't take any calls in the first hour, but that's what we're going to do this hour. And I'm going to take as many as I can, as quickly as I can, as long as I give you a good answer. I don't want to rush through the answer. You know me. So let's get right to the phones, 888-827-5536. Our first call of the day is Gary in Los Angeles. Gary, you're a patient man. Thank you.
Hi, Leo. I'm hoping that you give me some guidance, that you have your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the internet.
I do, and its heart rate is going up.
Hey, you know, I have two websites that I've designed and maintained over the years. And my web host has what they call a site of the month, in which they comment that the site has flash and movement and is interesting. And more recently, my techie friends have commented about my site, saying that you got to get rid of all that flash because all that movement is distracting. Which is it? What's taking place today in the minds of those that are on the internet? Are they more interested in seeing some degree of wow factor when they look at the site and see movement, or is it better to have a stagnant?
Stagnant, static. Well, let's not say stagnant. Hey, Gary, give me your URL so I could see this beautiful site for my very own.
Okay, one of them is collectmystimulus.com.
Collectmystimulus.com.
That's got a couple of animated GIFs.
And do you do these all yourself, or is this you got a designer with it, or what?
No, I do it myself.
Okay. Oh, yes, this is very elaborate. Look at that. Look at that. And wow, you've got the 20th Century Fox. Is that a movie, or is that Flash, that first thing there?
That's an animated GIF.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty good. Nice job. Let me explain why things are changing a little bit. Of course, nobody wants a boring site. Your site should be intriguing. It should be interesting. But remember, a couple of things have happened. First of all, Apple decided not to allow or not to include Flash. That's the animation technology that Adobe created that's widely used on the web. They do not support Flash on the iPhone or the iPad. And that's a lot of visitors. In fact, about 60% of all internet surfing on mobile is via the iPhone or the iPad. That means 60% of your mobile visitors cannot see anything in Flash. Can they see animated GIFs? Yes. But there's also an annoyance factor. So first of all, that's why Flash is being deprecated. It's also, by the way, not accessible. And so you don't want to leave out your blind users or users who, for one reason or another, can't access Flash. And in fact, even when you do this animated GIF at the beginning of your website, it's very, I mean, that attracts the mind. But how many seconds is that? Maybe 10 seconds, something like that, before the site pops up? One of the things we know is that people are very impatient as they surf. A blind user is not going to know what the heck's happening. There's a big image on the screen they don't see. But even users that can see it, even an iPad user, might not be patient enough to sit through that opening animation. These are called splash screens sometimes, and they are also considered by most designers to be a bad idea. You want to get right to the meat of the matter. You also want to be judicious in the use of animation. Remember, most of the web in the early days had mailboxes that would open and said, email me. They'd have dancing monkeys and all sorts of animation. That stuff does draw the eye, but it is not necessarily good design. And unless you're a designer, I'd be extremely cautious about how you put animation on your page. It slows it down in loading times. And again, slow loading times we know are a bad idea. There are modern technologies that do work on the iPad and the iPhone that don't slow you down so much. Most of them are based around the newest version of HTML, which is the web's markup language, HTML5. So I would take a look at that. Your page is fine, but I agree with your friends, and I would listen to truthfully, it's clearly not done by a designer. And I would, you know, if you really want to clean it up, it may be functional for what you do, and I think it probably is, but if you wanted to get awards for design, then you might want to go to a designer, somebody who's trained in graphic arts, and more than that, is trained in web design, because there is a, you know, really a web page is an application. It's really almost application user interface design that you need. So graphics, art, and an eye is important, but you also have to understand user interface. There's a really great resource for all of this. And in fact, the guy that I kind of look to for all of this information, he's the king of user interface design, and his name is escaping me right now, but I will find it for you, and I'll put it in our show notes at techguylabs.com. Chat room, you know who I'm talking about. His company, Jacob Nielsen, thank you very much, in Camden, Senza. Jacob Nielsen. His company, Nielsen Norman, does a lot of white papers and studies on how people use the web, how impatient they are, what they're looking for. And even if you're going to do this for yourself, I would definitely look at Nielsen Norman and some of the white papers that they've published so you understand a little bit better what it is that people are looking for. Donald Norman has written some very amazing books on design and function. They even have conferences. Usability Week 2011 is coming up in just a few days. And there are conferences in Toronto, New York City, San Francisco, Austin, and London. But read their stuff. You notice, by the way, when you go to the Nielsen Norman Group, nngroup.com, how barren their page looks. Doesn't it look kind of almost sparse? I think they're really focused on usability and accessibility for people who are blind and otherwise have a difficulty with the regular web. They know there's no Flash, there's no animated GIFs. It's very content focused. There's a bunch of interviews on the right, including iPad usability, how web ads work, lots of information. These guys are brilliant. So good luck. I think you've got a good, frankly, you've obviously got a good site that's working for you, but I agree. Let's not put Flash on it. Let's not put animated GIFs on it. It's not that good looking. Jonathan, Newport Beach, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. How are you, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, I'm hanging in there. Thank you. I tell you, I'm really into getting a mobile hotspot for my van.
Okay.
And I looked at them all, and they have a lot of rates out there, $50-$60 a month for flat rate.
Most of them are about $60 a month, yeah.
Yeah.
And most of them use 3G, by the way. They use the cell phone data network.
Yes. Yes, I guess they're using Sprint, most of them.
Not necessarily. You can go to Verizon, Sprint, and AT&T. All three sell mobile hotspots. They're Wi-Fi access points in a credit card-sized device. Some of them use 3G, 4G. Some of them just use 3G. And what they do is you turn them on. They pick up the data from the cell phone data network, and they make your car a Wi-Fi hotspot with up to five devices. It's actually a good technology, but it does cost you about $60 a month.
You're right. I got this van, and I actually probably sleep in the van 5 out of 7 nights a week.
Then you should do this. It would be worthwhile. A lot of truckers do this.
It seems fantastic, but here's my problem, is I want to get a phone, instead of using Skype, like on a third laptop to have telephone conversation, I want to get a Wi-Fi calling phone, and they claim a Time Warner, all this, yes.
It won't be fast enough. Here's what you should do. Get a phone that has a Wi-Fi hotspot built into it. Many, many phones do. My T-Mobile G2X does that. You can use the phone. You can use the Wi-Fi. You can even use Wi-Fi calling if you're near a Wi-Fi access point. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 4th of July weekend, and I guess we're going to play patriotic songs. You know, I had this, Kyle, in my playlist. I'm putting together a playlist for the picnic tomorrow. I'm in charge of the music. And then I listened to the lyrics, and it's kind of negative. It's the Guess Who, American Woman. So I took it out.
It's a good song.
It's a good song, but I never, you know, I'm not, for some reason, I don't really listen to lyrics. So I didn't really pay attention. I just thought, American Woman, oh, that sounds. But all he's saying is, get away from me, go away, go away. I don't think that's a good message. So I took that out of my list. But I did add Kate Smith, God Bless America. I'm doing a mix of patriotic and rock and roll, and you know, I actually asked on Google Circles. I said, looking for great songs for my 4th of July playlist. I got 148 recommendations. A lot of recommendations. So that's cool. Neil Diamond's America, ROCK in the USA, Bye Bye Miss American Pie, Tom Waits Going Out West. Look at all these. Of course, Born in the USA, Bob Seger. Lots of good stuff. Party in the USA by Miley Cyrus. I don't know. So this is kind of fun. I mean, this is one of the things the social network is really good at, saying, you know, what should I play at my 4th of July party? Lots of good suggestions. And then, of course, people look at the list and they use it too. So it's kind of, it's public. Everybody can participate. I like that. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Jonathan, Newport Beach. Oh, we talked to Jonathan. He was looking for a mobile hotspot. Again, just to reiterate, because I kind of got cut off at the end there, I really like the idea of, instead of buying a MiFi card, which is a mobile hotspot that uses the 3G network, look for a phone, and I think all the carriers are doing this now, for a small additional fee. T-Mobile only charges me $20 a month. I take my T-Mobile phone, and I can turn on the hotspot feature. And now this phone is like a MiFi. It shares its internet connection. Verizon phones can also do this in some cases. Usually it's an Android phone. iPhones, I don't know if iPhones, are they? I guess they're doing that now. Are they? Mobile hotspot? No, just tethering. So this phone then has that capability. Now, one of the things T-Mobile offers is Wi-Fi calling. But don't count on using 3G for Wi-Fi calling. I just don't think the 3G network is fast enough for reliable phone calls. But Wi-Fi calling, if you're in the, you know, you're in the office or at home with your Wi-Fi, is great. And T-Mobile no longer charges you for minutes used if you're Wi-Fi calling. So it's kind of almost like you have Skype built into that. I think it's a nice idea. So you can use an iPhone to do a mobile hotspot. Knox Harrington says you can. Okay. But you do pay an additional fee in most cases. But not as much as you would if you had the MiFi. Not $60 a month. Usually it's $20 or $30 a month. Lisa, San Jose, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Leo. It's funny that you mentioned that. I've never listened to the lyrics till just now. And as I was listening, I was going, boy, that's not a very nice song for
I know.
Women.
I know. So I'm not going to play that at my party.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Hey, I had a computer crash yesterday. Never had it happen. All of a sudden, I had actually written my email to ESET customer care, and before I could hit send, everything went kablooey. And what happened was I got a notice saying that there was a critical warning and that ESET had found a cryptic virus plus one other, and it happened so quickly I didn't get it all. But then I started getting this Microsoft thing that there's something wrong with the IDE, or was it APA disk, and here are all these utilities that ran some tests and said, this is critical, this is not, this is, and run these things and won't let me do anything else. And I don't know, is that a part of the virus?
I don't think, I think in this case it's not a virus, that your hard drive failed.
Okay.
I'm not sure what all these warnings are. I'm not even sure. You know, there's a whole category of viruses called scareware. In fact, it's the most lucrative form of virus now, where you pose as Microsoft or an antivirus, and you say, hey, I just discovered 38 viruses on your computer, but if you give me $59, I'll fix it.
Yeah, no, these were just things that said to run right then and there. There's no money involved.
Yeah,
no.
And so that tells me that these are real. And I don't know if it's a virus. I think it's probably, I mean, the critical warnings about your hard drive are the ones I'd pay attention to.
Right.
What did ESET say when you got the message?
Store, but before I did that, I was thinking of running what it said to run when it wasn't connected to the internet.
Right.
Because one of the warnings I kept getting is your personal information may be at risk.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, good. I'm new.
Well, I don't. You know, I'm not sure if that was a true ESET warning or not. That's the problem. You know, what these bad guys do is they really make it look just like it came from Microsoft or Norton or ESET. Because they think that'll fool people. You don't see a lot of fake. In fact, I've never seen a fake ESET, because ESET isn't, you know, one of the big two, McAfee and Norton. That's an easier one to impersonate.
It wasn't coming from ESET. It had the look of, it said XP recovery something or other, and it was definitely not. I knew something was wrong.
That's a fake. Yeah, that's a fake. I think. Again, not seeing it, I can't tell. Your system right now won't boot at all.
No, it goes right back to that, run these things. And then when I did manage to get into it once, a little bit, I noticed that all my docs were gone, everything.
You got bit.
It said Word was gone and everything.
Well, I can't tell. There's two possibilities. One is that your hard drive, in fact, started to fail. And that's what you're seeing is some damage to the hard drive. Now, here's the good news. In most cases, you can get that data off of there, but you won't be able to do it with that system. You'll have to bring it into somebody.
Right, and that's what I'm ready to do.
I think you should do that. When you bring it in, they should be able to tell immediately if this is real or if it's blackmail software. You know, this is what the scareware does. The new kind of angle on this is they make your computer non-functioning, and they say, however, we can fix this if you send us money. But they're not asking for money, are they?
Oh, I couldn't even get into an email or anything at the moment. There's nothing coming through.
So what is the pop-up you're getting?
I had done a print screen, and I didn't get a chance to really look at it because then it really died. And it looks like it's running through different kinds of tests, this drive, this kind of application, and it's telling me whether it's critical or whether it's not, and virtually all of it was red and critical. And then it says run these, you know, press here to run these repairs, and that's all I can do. It won't go in any further than that. But the screen behind that is totally black.
Well, there's a couple of things. If you bring it in, they'll have the tools you can run. Microsoft has a standalone scanner, rootkit scanner, that is on a CD that they could pop in. I'm sure they'll pop in and they'll run it against your computer. It could either be a failed hard drive or you could have malware on there, and I just can't tell from your from the description, I'm afraid. And I think that's why you're going to need to bring it in and have an expert look at it. And bring it to somebody good, because if it's a good person, they'll be able to get your data. They'll be able to recover your data, almost certainly.
And that's what I'd like to do. But I also have a really silly ESET question. I'm used to old things where they quarantine and then you have to do something. With the ESET, you do nothing?
Like, well, the times have changed. The idea of a quarantine is a virus got on your system and we can isolate that file and move it off. Virus authors years ago figured that trick out, and they started attaching their viruses to critical system files. You quarantine a critical system file, you don't have a system that boots. So the quarantine method is kind of is not widely used anymore. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. David in San Francisco listening to the great KGO. What can I do
Hello?
For you, David? Hi, David.
Hi there. Okay, so I'm looking for a wireless home monitoring system that works with the internet. So, like, for example, when I'm away on vacation, I want to go to somebody's computer and go to a website and look at the cameras in my home and see that everything is okay. And if there are burglars, the images of the burglars will be recorded. So, unfortunately, all the products I've found so far are either too complicated to set up. They have poor image quality, especially at night. They don't work with my MacBook, or they're really expensive.
I'm not sure I can fix all of those problems. I'll tell you what we've been using. We have a DropCam. Have you looked at DropCam?
A DropCam. I've heard of that.
Yeah, DropCam.com. They're very simple to set up. Okay. We have one set up at our new studio so we can watch the construction. In fact, if you go to DropCam.com and go to the demo page, you'll see New Twit Studios. And I'll tell you couple of the features. First of all, it's not inexpensive. If you don't want audio, it's $200. If you want to add audio, it's $279. But they do some interesting things. First of all, very easy to set up. The camera itself only needs power. It has a built-in Wi-Fi capability, so it can stream via Wi-Fi. You'll have to have Wi-Fi in the house you're monitoring. But if you do
I will need Wi-Fi.
Yeah. You're going to have some, I mean, think about it. You've got to have internet access for this camera.
Right.
No camera is going to get on the internet without internet access. So you set up Wi-Fi in your house. That's nice because it's wireless. So you only have to power the camera. They use Axis cameras. In fact, DropCam is an Axis company. So there are other AXIS, other Axis cameras that do similar things. The DropCam was designed to be very consumer focused. And one of the things that they do that I really like is they record, they essentially have a DVR for you. Let me pull up the DropCam site and show you. If you go to bit.ly/... you can go to DropCam.com, but I can... Our DropCam that's set up right now is bit.ly/twitdrop. But you don't need to... I mean, that's only if you want to see it. But what this does that I really particularly like is it records... if for free, I think it records a day or two, but you can pay for more and it'll actually record a week at a time. So you actually have a timeline that you can zip back through and you can go to a particular time. So if you know that, or you thought that your house had been burglarized at a certain time, you can go back and you can get it. It's just like one of those recorders, but the recorder's online.
Great.
Which I think is really nice.
Great.
Yeah, and if you have the audio camera, you can both look and hear. That's the Dropcam Echo. That's the one we're using. And I think the quality is good, although I have to say, it, you know, if you turn off all the lights, you're not going to see anything. Right. So you might want to leave some lights on in the house. Okay. If you want 7 days of rolling storage, it's $9 a month. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. You can even buy 30 days of rolling storage, so it will record the last 30 days automatically. You can go back in time.
And can you turn that off and on so when you're not on vacation, you're not recording it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know,
cool.
They even have an iPhone app, which is neat, so you don't even have to go to a friend's website. You can do this on a mobile device like your phone. You can take a look at your drop cam and see what's going on.
So does it work? So does the camera, the Wi-Fi camera, work via my MacBook?
Well, you'll need a Wi-Fi access spot. Do you use Wi-Fi when you're in the house?
No, I use a DSL modem.
Yeah, so what you'll need to do, but it's not expensive, you'll need to go out and buy a $40 Wi-Fi router and connect that to the DSL modem.
Okay.
The other option is to get one that has a hardwired Ethernet jack in it, but that means you have to run an Ethernet cable to it. So you really kind of want to use Wi-Fi so you don't have to run an Ethernet cable to the camera.
Gotcha.
Actually, the Dropcam has Ethernet in it, I think, doesn't it? Yeah. So you have your choice. You could use a hardwired, but you don't want to use hardwired because then you got blue cables all over the house.
Right, right. Yeah.
So this is why the Wi-Fi is nice.
That sounds good.
Yeah, I've been very happy with it. We've had this running since January when we first started the construction project, so it's been very reliable. And I can pause it. I can go back through it. I can go through the. I don't know where the timeline is. I don't know what's. Why am I not getting a timeline on this thing anymore? Maybe it's something we turned off. But you used to be able to go back in time. So you could. Yeah, let's see. Twitch Studios camera. There it is. There's the timeline. So I can go back. I can go back to any time in the last week. I can even jump to a time and date in the last week, because we've got the rolling. So I can go back to June 27th, and let's go to 10 a.m. and see what was going on at that time, and you'll get audio and video. I'll play a little bit of the audio for you so you can hear them. It's not super high fidelity, but certainly enough to hear people talking and know what they're doing. Apparently nothing going on in the studios on June, which is why it's taken us 6 months to finish. Great way to keep up on your construction crew, by the way. Yeah, that's they're very busy there right now. Let's see what we were doing yesterday. Absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. It's dead silent. All right, well, there you go. Maybe I should. That's the modern way of keeping up on your construction crew. I like this a lot. There are a lot of other choices, but I have to say we've been pretty happy with the drop cam. Let's move on to Amsterdam. Derek, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm 15 years old, and I've been programming since I was 9. I specialize in web design, web access, accessibility standards, Java, and databases.
That's awesome. I can't. First of all, your English is perfect, Derek.
Yeah, I come from America. I've lived there for 8 years.
Oh, okay. Okay. You do have a little. I thought you might be Dutch because you have a little bit of a Dutch accent, but that's something you acquired having moved to Holland.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm very impressed by your. You sound almost like an American. Oh, you are. Well, that's great. So you started when you were 9. What did you start with, Derek? What language did you start with?
Well, you know, on IRC, you have the Microsoft client.
So you were writing scripts for IRC, things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
indeed.
It's, you know, it doesn't really matter what language you learn with. It's the motivation. And obviously, because you were using chat, IRC chat, and you were motivated to learn how to script it, that was enough. That was sufficient to teach you programming. A lot of people learn a BASIC that way or JavaScript that way because they're motivated to solve a problem. If you were going to do it academically, You know, if you go to MIT, for instance, they probably would start you with Java. I'm kind of a fan of Lisp, which is maybe not a great production language, the kind of language you use to write commercial software. It's about teaching you and helping you understand the ideas of programming. In fact, when they teach Lisp, and they used to teach Lisp at MIT for years, that was the first programming language they taught you. They said, we're not teaching you how to control a computer. We're teaching you how to express algorithms and ideas in a language, in a syntax. And it's a much better context, much better way to think about programming than how do I get the computer to do this? You can get to that later. You learned the other way, and I bet you're doing just fine. So what can I do to help you?
Well, my problem is I'm 15 years old, and my dad is like, you know, you got to get a job sometime. So
you want a programming job because that's what you love.
Yeah.
Well, let me help you. We're going to take a break. I'm going to help you figure that out. Don't go away. From Amsterdam, Derek, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Now, you may wonder what this has to do with Independence Day, but remember, the name of the group is America. Did I get it right?
Awesome, Leo.
Kyle Benham, trying to trick me. Pretty much now, on the show, it's a guessing game as to why Kyle played the song, and you have to kind of... It's a good puzzle. It's a good brain teaser. Keep you young. 8888 Ask Leo. Speaking of young, Derek's on the line. 15 years old. Started programming when he was 9 years old. He's an expert in Java, which is probably the one of the best languages to learn right now. He is an expert in accessibility, web pages, and that kind of thing. And he says, Dad says I have to get a job, but nobody will hire me because I'm 15. Is that right, Derek?
Yeah, it is.
Well, you know, I got to point out that Bill Gates, when he was your age, started a company called Traf-O-Data with Paul Allen, and they wrote software for the devices that cities use to measure traffic. You know, they put those little rubber hoses on the roadway, and the cars go boom, boom, over them. And Gates and Allen's first company, before Microsoft, this Traf-O-Data company, they counted cars, and they sold it to cities, and it actually was a pretty good little business for them. So it's possible at the age of 15. In fact, you should tell Dad this story, because maybe Dad will be... Is Dad in the business? Is he a computer kind of guy?
Oh, no, he's a professional car player.
See, that's the problem. See, he wants you to do something with your hands, doesn't he?
Yeah, I guess.
He says, you should learn a trade. This programming thing's not going anywhere. Now, Bill Gates' dad was a lawyer, so I think he probably was, and they were wealthy, so I think he was probably like, yeah, whatever, kid. But I understand. Your dad says, I want you to get a job. You're 15. It's time to get a job. That's completely reasonable. And I think it's reasonable for you to say, well, here's what I really love, and I want to get a job as a programmer. How do we help, let me ask the chat room, how do we help Derek overcome, I know, don't tell anybody you're 15, and do it via the internet. How about that? There's a site, I don't know if it's good in Holland or not, but you could take a look at it, called Elance, ELANCE.com. Hire online workers, get the job done. People will post a job, so you can make a proposal to somebody who's already said, I need something. So you can search here for somebody who says, I want to do some accessibility programming in Java, and you go, that's me. And you can post a proposal there. You don't have to say I'm 15. And the truth is, in the computer world, I don't think that's a strike against you. If you're responsible, hardworking, I think you could probably do very well.
Yeah, I've tried one of those sites like that. But the problem is, I've already earned about $1.50. But they keep the fees.
Yeah.
30 to 40% of what I earn.
Well, that may just be something you have to put up with until you get enough work under your belt, enough examples of what you've done under your belt. And the nice thing is, because you're doing these on the web, you could point people to websites, say, I did that. I see that. I did that. And that will make it easier for you to get work. And once people see that you are reliable, that you complete the job on time and on budget, that you do good work, I don't think anybody's going to worry about your age. In fact, I think there's definitely the feeling in the computer world that it's your generation that is going to change the world, that knows a lot about this. How about this, Derek? Why don't you make your own website? Put some stuff on there that you've written.
I've got one already, actually.
Oh, what's the site?
I'm not sure how to say it in English, but it's kolakcc.com.
kolakcc.com. Is that right?
CC, sorry.
CC. Aspiring freelancer. I like this. Good job. This is exactly what you need to do. Here's your expertise on here. This is fantastic. Now, you could do more, though. You know, you got planned projects. Do you have any projects you've completed on here?
Not any I'm ready to upload yet.
Yeah. So that's the next step, is maybe to put some stuff up there that's an example of your work. You know, I'll be honest. What I encourage kids today to do is to become entrepreneurial, to not look for a job, even though dad's pushing you to do that, but to create your own job, to create your own business. What do you think? I mean, Bill Gates was your age. Instead of saying, let me see if I can go down to Control Data and get a job as a programmer, he wrote Trafo Data and started a business. Maybe that's the thing to do. You got any good ideas for a website?
Not really, to be honest.
Start thinking about those. See if you can come up with a great idea and implement it.
Okay.
Don't you
Will
think?
Do.
Derek, hang in there. I know Dad wants you to learn a trade, and it's not a bad thing to do. Not that you'll end up doing it, but just it's great to know things about how to do things, and it's great to work with your hands. I think a lot of programmers, in fact, do have hobbies where they work physically, because after you work with your brain all day, you kind of sometimes it's nice to go home and do a little woodwork or, paint a painting, do something physical. So it's not a bad idea to do that too. But I think you may not believe this, you're in a very exciting time for people like you, because the playing field has flattened a little bit, and if you have skills, you can start a business. It's we call it barrier to entry. The difficulty of starting your own website or starting your own business is it's almost down to zero. You can create a site on Amazon's EC2, for instance, and it just costs you $15 a month, something like that, and you can get a great site. Wouldn't Dad be impressed if you created a site and then got some venture capital to start a business? Wouldn't Dad be pretty amazed? I'd start thinking entrepreneurially, Derek. I think there's a real opportunity for you. And nobody cares about your age. They care about what you've done. Show them what you can do. Billy, Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Billy, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi. First time caller. Enjoy your show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I've got a complicated question. I right now do not own a flat screen TV or whatsoever, and still on a tube TV with a converter box.
It's about time. This is exciting, Billy. You're gonna love a new TV.
I have a dilemma, because I know this LCD 720 and 1080, and the next step up is LED 720, 1080, same thing. I know LED supposedly is better than LCD, but when I look at the LED in the store and look at an LCD, I can't tell very much of the difference. Is there any good points of the LED compared to in other words, is...
Yeah, let me explain first, Billy, the difference. They're both LCDs. The difference between an LED and a standard LCD is the backlight. That's the only difference. So the way an LCD works, a liquid crystal display, the liquid crystals are just shutters that open and close when you want to light up that dot on the screen. It's the light behind them that's changing. It's either fluorescent tubes in the old style LCDs or these more modern LCDs, which use LEDs for the backlight. The image quality on LED is marginally better, but there's other benefits. They don't burn out. They maintain their color consistency longer. LED is a good way to go. And most of the high-end modern LCD flat panels use LED backlights. So they call them LEDs, but it's not an LED. It's still an LCD. It's just backlit by an LED.
So in other words, you're better off buying an LED.
I think so. They're brighter. They last longer. It's not so much that they're better image quality, although it is true that they tend to be more evenly lit, better blacks, that kind of thing.
All right. Then the other question I got, they say...
Well, I'll tell you what. I hear the magic sound, which tells me we've got a break for news. Do you have time to hang on through the news? And I'll get back to you right after this.
Okay.
Please do. Thank you, Billy. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time to talk about computers and the internet and cell phones. And I promise not to talk in a voice like that. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number if you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion. I'd love to hear from you. We love to talk about technology. I was talking to Billy in Providence about buying a new TV. Poor Billy's been watching a plain old tube TV. He's getting his first HD TV. So question number one was LCD or LED. And as you probably heard, the answer is they're both LCDs. It's just how the backlight is. And I do strongly recommend, unless it's much, much more expensive, an LED backlit. They'll be newer for one thing. I don't think anybody, I think most people are not making the fluorescent light backlit. And the color is more consistent. They last longer. They use less power. There are a lot of good reasons to use an LED backlit LCD.
Well, you made my mind up about that. That's what I'm going to do. Now, my other three questions before I let you go is, if I financially can only afford a 720p LED, is it best to buy a Blu-ray player with that? Some say it's not worth it because you won't get the full effect. Some people say it is. Or is it best to go with this new thing now called a DVD up converter?
So 720p is high def. And a TV that you buy that's 720p is probably also 1080i. Those are the older TVs. The newer TVs are 1080p. Blu-ray is capable of a full 1,080 lines from top to bottom. That's 1080p. And certainly it will look better. But it's not, frankly, it's not whether the TV does 720, 1080, or that. It's how big the screen is. On a smaller screen, you might not notice the difference between DVD upscaled and Blu-ray. On a bigger screen, you certainly will. How big a screen are you thinking about getting?
Well, I live in a studio apartment, which is like living room, bedroom combined. And I know most, can I mention a brand? Or
yeah, of course. Love it.
Ever hear of Vizio?
Vizio's excellent. Vizio's a good deal. They sell them in the big box stores. I think they make very, very good HD TVs. They're not the top tier. They're the second tier after Sony and Panasonic and Samsung. But I think they're very good. So if money is an issue, absolutely, Vizio is a good choice.
All right. So you would be talking, say, if I get a 32, would that
32? Then don't even. It's fine. In fact, they probably don't make a 1080p 32 because there's no point.
Right. I know some other companies do, like
32
LG
is pretty.
Or,
yeah, 32 is pretty small. You know, I would look at 42 or even 50 inches if you can. I know it's a small apartment, but 50 inches, even if you're sitting 10 feet, only 10 feet away, 50 inches is a good size. You don't want to get it too small.
Now, these up converters, DVD.
They're fine. What they do is they take a DVD. Now, a DVD, just so you understand the numbers, is 480 lines from top to bottom. So HD is 720 or 1080. So what an up converter does is it takes the 480 lines and it uses software and a processor to make it kind of smooth out the jaggies that come when you blow up 480 to 720. So to be honest, on a good up converter DVD on 720p, that looks pretty darn good, especially considering where you're moving from.
See, the thing of it is, Vizio doesn't make no DVD up converters. The only one, all they do is make Blu-ray machines on the Vizio.
At this point, though, you might want to buy a Blu-ray DVD player. They're pretty cheap.
So, what would be to say? It's not worth buying a Blu-ray if the screen is smaller than 32. Or what?
Truthfully, what is it? What does the Blu-ray cost? $100, $150? It's not expensive.
Blu-rays now have come down dramatically. They were up like when it came out.
Right, so I don't think you should even worry. Get a Blu-ray player because it'll work with your next TV. If you get another TV, it'll work with the standard DVDs. Blu-ray players are up converting, so your DVDs will look better. You'll be able to play Blu-ray discs, which will look the best. So I think you should probably get a Blu-ray player, even if you're getting a 32-inch TV. You might not notice as much difference, but I think you should.
Now, one last question before I let you go, since you've given me all the answers on what I'm going to do. I notice when I'm going into some box stores, especially on the Vizio TVs that are like 26-inch LED, which is about 300, then they go up from that. Mostly all their products are not shrink wrapped. You know what I mean by shrink wrap? The boxes?
Yeah.
What's the reason for that? Because I'll give an example. On the Blu-ray machines, which they only make, it's like opening up a suitcase. There's no shrink wrap around the outer side where you open it. Their reason why is it just because it's cost-cutting to put shrink wrap on
the outside? I'm sure it is, but I'd be really cautious and make sure it doesn't look like that box was opened and the stuff was taken out and set up and put back in. It's not that you're going to necessarily have a problem with that, but I'd like to see a nice, clean box with nice, sharp edges that doesn't look like it's been opened and used before.
All right. Thank you for your time, and I will take your advice on that.
Good, Billy. One more tip. Don't buy the cables at the expensive store. Sometimes they'll really upsell you on cables. It's a good way for them to make a lot of extra money. You don't need expensive HDMI cables. If they're more than $10 or $15, just say thanks, no thanks. Get them online at monoprice.com. There's no reason to spend $80 or $90 or more on an HDMI cable. It's not that there's no advantage to that. And it is one of the ways that these stores, not so much the big box stores, but some of the fancy video stores will make a little extra money on you. You say, yeah, by the way, you need the high-fidelity HDMI cable for that, and that'll be $152. And just say no. Monoprice, MonoPrice.com. That same cable, $5. That's where you can save money reasonably. Javier from Garden Grove, California. Javier, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Welcome to the show. Happy Independence Day.
Oh, yeah. Happy 4th of July to you, too.
Thank you.
I just want to, thank you for taking my call. I've always listened to you. Thanks for all the advice. I have a problem.
Okay.
All right. Well, last week, I have a MacBook Pro, and it's not new. I got it in 08, and just last week, it was freezing on me, and the screen was pixelated, and everyone's telling me maybe it's the hard drive going down.
Not if the screen is pixelated. That sounds more like the logic board. One of the things that happens with laptops, and I've noticed it happens a lot with MacBooks, is as you handle them, the body itself, especially the older MacBooks, the non-unibodies, that's one of the reasons I think they went to the unibody design. They torque a little bit, and that actually can torque the logic board in there, and that you'd get exactly the kind of problems you're seeing. Now, it may be something that's easy to fix, but I think if you bring it to an Apple store, they're going to say, you need a new logic board, and that's $1,000.
Yeah, oh, really?
You'd be better off just buying a new laptop.
That was plan B. My plan A was just, everyone with my friends was telling me, your hard drive works like crazy all the time. I use it for work.
I don't think it's the hard drive. The pixelation is a couple of things. The video card's bad. The cable is bad. Some of those laptops did have problems with their video cards. Now, that Apple will fix. Even though it's out of warranty, Apple will fix because it was their fault. So it's not a bad idea to bring it to the Apple store, say, hey, is this that NVIDIA problem? Is that the 8600M NVIDIA graphics problem? And they'll say, oh, yeah, sorry. And they will swap it for free if it's that.
Oh, okay, so the NVIDIA problem. So you don't think there was anything wrong with the hard drive?
Well, I can't say for sure because I don't have it in my hands, but when you talk about that particular problem, it sounds like a hardware problem, not a hard drive problem.
Yeah, because I would do a hard reboot, and then I would try it again, and it would it would restart like normal. I would work on it, and then it would just... It did it to me like 3 times. And then
it could also be overheating, but that does sound like it's a hardware problem, not a hard drive problem.
So I went ahead and I went to the store and I got a new hard drive. I installed it.
Did that fix it?
It was like I was getting ready to install the OS on it, I guess I needed to reformat it. So I'm not sure if... Now I'm not sure if it was the hard drive.
It's not the hard drive. It's the hardware. You need to bring it to the Apple store. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yes, this is on my list. Neil Young. Rocking in the free world on Independence Day weekend 2011. Phone number 8888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. If you don't remember the phone number, don't worry. All you have to remember is the website, techguylabs.com. Everything's there, including the phone number, the video, the audio from 784 shows. Show notes, thanks to James DeRuvo. Actually, I think the show notes are a little slower this weekend because I think James is is off enjoying. He does scouting and stuff. I think he's enjoying his Sunday, but he'll get those show notes up later in the day. He's very good about that. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number if you want to get on the show. JoJo, Foster City, California. Hi, JoJo. Leo Laporte, the tech.
Hi, good afternoon, Leo. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks
you
for calling.
Are the master.
Thank you, sir.
I have a simple computing question for you. Just purchased a new laptop, and when the sales guy sold it to me, he said it would come with the standard operating system disks and drivers that they do, but it didn't, and I'm coming to find out that is it now common for new laptops or a computer to not come with the actual operating system disks and drivers?
Yes.
Crashes.
Yeah. So the reason, and I agree with you, you want those disks. What you'd really like, if you had your choice, is a standard Windows 7 install disk, not a restore disk. That would be the second best thing. But no disks at all is really not a good solution. Now, presumably, and you should see, most companies that do this will say you can make your own disks. They'll have a partition on the drive, and there'll be a program you can run, and you can make your own disks. Is that the case?
That's what they are telling me. I ended up calling the manufacturer directly, and that's what they say, that there is a there should be or could be a partition there. You can make your own disk. It just kind of, I'm a novice. If I don't want to screw up.
I don't blame you. And I tell you, I'm not a novice, and I have screwed up the make your own disk thing. You only get one shot at it. Because they don't want you making disks for your friends. All of this comes from one simple thing. Microsoft knows we're thieves and will steal them blind. They're just like the shopkeeper who has the apples in front of the store and stands there glaring at everybody who walks by. Don't touch my apples! It's not a very friendly thing to do, is it?
They explained it to me like, well, the companies are going green and they don't want to.
That's not green. Nothing to do with that. Because you're going to burn disks. That's exactly the same thing, right?
I have to go burn one myself. Right?
It's the same thing. No, it doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with piracy. Microsoft actually charges the company less for that copy of Windows if the company doesn't give you a disk. Because Microsoft is convinced that if they give you a disk, you will steal them blind.
I'm just one little guy.
Oh, believe me, it's stupid. Most people, even the music industry, is starting to realize that this idea of treating your customers as thieves is counterproductive, is the wrong thing to do. Believe me, if you are a thief, this doesn't slow you down. It's easy to steal Windows.
Right, and I'm a disabled guy, and doing all these extra things are really hard. It's really hard to do these things, sit there and then they're telling me that, I could have paid extra to have them wipe out all the junkware. Why does it even come with junkware? So I'm going to have to take time to clean out the junkware.
Where did you buy the computer?
Oh, it's at probably the bottom of the barrel, but, it's Office Max. There was a sale going on.
And what was the brand? Was it their house brand?
It was Acer.
Acer. No, Acer's a very good company. That's a fine computer. Acer does what most other companies do. In fact, the fact that they even offer you an option to remove the crapware is nice. They make money on that. All of those little trial buttons on that desktop, every one of those companies paid them.
Well, they want me to pay them $150 to go ahead and remove all of that, set up the security, set up the Windows firewall, which is things I think I can do, just add, remove the software. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would recommend you do that.
And then setting up a Windows firewall, that's just go in there and do it.
It's a checkbox.
Right.
In fact, it's already set. If it's Windows 7, it's already set up and on.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is.
Yeah.
And I'd like ESET. It comes with a free 30 days of McAfee. I'm thinking about wiping that
off
immediately.
Yes.
ESET. Is that a good idea?
Absolutely. See, what happens is McAfee paid Acer, I don't know, $5. Because they figure that, and in most cases they're right, that you're just going to say, okay, I got it, I'll use it, and then next year you'll give them some more money and some more money. So they paid Acer money to be the default antivirus on there.
Of course.
But none of that's to your benefit. It's all about Acer. Now, let me explain that we did kind of create this situation by putting pressure on companies to drop the prices. You got that Acer really cheap.
It is. It was on sale.
Yeah.
It was like $479
yeah.
for...
The reason that's $479 is because Acer didn't have to pay the extra $15 to Microsoft. Acer got $5 from McAfee and a bunch of other companies. The profit margin is so narrow in computers these days because they're so inexpensive that they have to do this. By the way, the other thing, and you haven't found this part yet, but you will, tech support is virtually non-existent.
Oh, that was what I was very concerned about, and it is... You have to pay, you know, $200 for a couple of years, another $99 for something else.
But that makes sense because think about it. They've unbundled it, basically. You used to – look, that computer cost you $2,000 10 years ago.
Right, and it came – like my old Dell.
And it came with support. They had the price already bundled in. So all they've done is they've taken that out and said, you want it? Because some people don't want it. They say, you want it? You'll pay the money. But if you don't, you don't have to. That's not a bad thing.
I see. And I was thinking, you know, the one-year warranty comes with hardware support and 90 days worth of operating system support. If I have a problem, I can go ahead and call Acer and purchase it then. They said that's okay.
That's the way to do it. And just cross your fingers you don't have a problem.
Oh, fantastic. And one question about them. I'm only going to use, for in the meantime, while I'm waiting for my operating system disk from the company, I am going to go ahead and try and, you know, make one of my own. Which one is better as far as DVDs? Does it matter? Is it DVD-R or DVD-plus-R? I don't know these things, really.
Makes no never mind.
It does. And if it's an old one, like a six-year-old blank set that I've had for a while that I've been using, or should I just go out and buy a new set of these DVD-Rs?
If you've stored them in the dark and they haven't gotten wet, I think you're probably all right. If it burns okay, then you're all right.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just been in a cave for 10 years and trying to catch up on all
stuff. Things have changed. I mean, that's what's changed over 10 years is that the prices have tumbled, margins are razor thin, so companies are doing everything they can to make a little money. And if you look at the profit margins, it takes HP 7 computers to make the same amount of money Apple computer makes on one computer. Apples are a lot more expensive, aren't they? But they bundle in support, you get discs. I mean, that's the difference. So, I mean, you have a choice. You can all, you know, if you buy a Dell, for instance, you can say for an additional fee, include the discs, take off the junk. Acer apparently does the same thing. So you can pay for it. So we, in a way, we created this by demanding lower prices, by responding to these lower prices. But you have to understand, this is the cost of a lower price. They're unbundling a lot of the things that you used to get for free, like support, like discs. I mean, that's what's happened. As long as you understand that, I think then you can wrap your head around it and get what you need to make it work for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Actually, I literally am sitting on air. I'm sitting on an inflated ball right now. I've been doing that for about 5 years. Was that Leo Sayre? I think it was Leo Sayre, TK. Our chat room, if you'd like to get in there, just go to techguylabs.com and click the chat link. There's some great people. And lots of good moderators keeping it clean. 684 people in chat. Dan and Can We Bowl, Please, and Hip, and Houdini7, and Icon, and Kevin, and Life's a Zoo, and Mick, and Nightflyer, and Warpoli. Keeping an eye on things. Thank you guys for, they're volunteer moderators, and they do a great job. We really appreciate it. Phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO, and we're going to get right back to the phones. Mike is on the line from Glendale. Hey, Mike, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Joey Scarberry. That's right. Thank you. Sorry.
I have 17,500 Napster files on a computer that I moved from an older computer, and every one of them has Napster's DRM.
Oh, I hate them. So it isn't the old Napster. It's the new Napster.
It's the new Napster. Yeah. And I've already paid for these.
No, you didn't. Think you did. You gave them money. But you didn't buy those songs, you rented them.
Oh. I don't want to get into that distinction right now.
I don't blame you. So their DRM isn't working anymore.
It's keeping me from playing the darn songs.
Yeah.
If I try and play one, I don't have the rights to play it.
Right.
And if I go to the properties of it, it says that it has... I don't have the rights. You know, if you go to the right click on the file name and you click properties, it says this is a protected file.
Yeah. I hate DRM for this very reason, because you gave them money and you believed you were in contract with them to purchase music.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
However, I suspect if you look at the terms of service and that little fine print down there, what you've really done is you've leased the music. You don't own the music, even though you paid exactly the same amount, and maybe in some cases more than you would have had you bought it. So I'm just looking through what time period, what time frame was this that you bought?
This is probably 3 years ago, yeah. And there are a number of applications you can find and download from the free websites that say this file will take care of Napster's DRM. And one of them is like MUB Audio.
Yeah, this is illegal, basically. This is stripping the DRM out. So that's, here's what happened. Napster went bankrupt. And they were purchased at a bankruptcy auction by Roxio, which used them to rebrand Roxio's own music service as Napster 2.0. And then in 2008, Roxio sold them to Best Buy for a mere $121 million. Now, that doesn't sound like a small amount of money. It is for what Napster represented. So I don't know what's happened, if Best Buy no longer is running the Napster DRM servers, or if you have to unlock Napster music somehow. You're running Windows Media Player to listen to the music?
I'm not running anything right now because, I mean, I have tried a number of different media players and none of them work.
Yeah.
So,
my suspicion, see, I'm not sure exactly. It depends on the vintage of your Napster music. It sounds like what happened is the DRM, the copy protection, digital rights management software that they used when you bought those songs. In most cases, what happens is the song, when you play it through Windows Media Server or maybe a special Napster application, and then it goes and it checks the copy protection server. Did you buy those songs outright, or did you have a monthly?
I had the monthly deal.
Oh, well, then you don't own those songs anyway. You're not supposed to be able to play them. You only were able to play them as long as you had a Napster account.
I remember that. So I've got 17,500 useless songs.
Delete them. You don't own them. And don't be surprised, because that's the deal. It was as long as you had a monthly subscription, you could play them. Now, you could, of course, if they're still offering that service and it still works with those songs, you could sign up and pay the monthly fee again. This is the same in the Zune. If you have a Zune Pass, if you have Rhapsody, if you have RDO, if you have MOG, there are a number of these services that are monthly subscription services. You can listen to any song they've got as long as you keep paying that monthly fee. But stop paying the fee. I don't care if you downloaded them or not. You can't play those songs. You don't own them. Now, there's also the situation. So those are the subscription songs. Now, you may have also purchased songs thinking you owned them from them, songs that still had copy protection on them, and then they've stopped running the copy protection server. If that's the case, you might have an argument there that, well, I bought these songs, but the copy protection, you stopped unlocking them. So there's a question of, did you rent them or did you buy them? And even if you bought them, and this is why you absolutely should not buy copy protected anything. For the copy protection to work, it has to call a server online and say, hey, can I play this? Is it okay? The server has to respond, yes. At the minute they take that server down, you can't play that music. It's not like you bought a CD that'll play forever. Terrible, terrible thing, copy protection. Should be illegal. Shouldn't be allowed. And in fact, here's the irony. The music industry has even realized this, and they're no longer putting copy protection on music you buy from Amazon or iTunes or any, most of these digital places. It isn't copy protected. But do remember this: when you do a subscription service, a monthly subscription service, Rhapsody, Napster, Zune, the Zune Pass, you're only going to be able to play that music as long as you pay the subscription fee. As soon as you stop paying, that music, I don't care if it's on your hard drive or not, is not playable. It's done. You're only renting it. It's like telling your landlord. It's like saying to your landlord, hey, I rented this house last year. Can I just move in tonight? No! Wayne, Clearwater, Florida. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good afternoon, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Happy 4th of July weekend.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I've got Adobe Photoshop's Elements 4.0, and I've backed up all of my photos to disks, but the only thing I've got are a bunch of photographs. I don't have them in the groups or the collections that they're located in. Is there a way that I can back them up to the various locations or collections?
Yeah, I think if you use the Adobe Elements software itself to do the backup, it will back up. See, there's the files themselves, which is good. You still have those. Thank goodness. You haven't lost your pictures. But you did a lot of organizational stuff, and that's stored in a separate index file, the folders and all that stuff. I don't use Adobe Elements as is it Adobe Elements or Adobe Album? What is it that you're using?
It's Elements, and I've had it for a number of years. I just I paid for it along with the movie version, and I just have not wanted to go to any other program to do anything with, just because I'm kind of cheap. But
so if you do what I think what you did, which is just drag the files off, yeah, all you're going to get is the files. If you use Elements to back up the catalog, then you will have everything. So you go to the file menu, and you'll see there is in the file menu backup catalog. You could back it up to a CD, DVD, a hard drive. That will keep all of the folders you used, all of the additional stuff that you did, the modifications, all of that will be preserved, but you can't just copy it over. But there is a so in other words, do the backup from within Elements. This is true of a lot of software, Picasa, Adobe Album software, iPhoto, and so forth. Just copying the images isn't going to do it. You need to copy the catalog as well. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Lee Greenwood, happy Independence Day weekend. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know, I wrote an essay about 10 years ago about Independence Day and our founding fathers and how different things might have been had Ben Franklin been able to prepare a PowerPoint to show George III about why we should be independent. and had we had email... That Declaration of Independence might not have taken, a year to ratify. I wonder, it hasn't happened yet, but I have to think that the fact that we are now, thanks to the internet, able to communicate globally, directly with people, not their governments, but directly with people, ultimately, doesn't that support peace? Doesn't that help bring us together? And doesn't it support democracy in the long run? Look at the Arab Spring that we had, where Tunisia and Yemen and Egypt and all these countries, because of the access to the internet and the access to the outside world and the ability to communicate with each other freely, made those first key steps towards freedom. I really have to think that this technology of ours is the ultimate democratizing force. I really do believe that. And who knows what this world will look like 10, 20 years from now. And it's the best, frankly, hope for peace we have ever had. That's one of the reasons that I care so much about technology. It's not about the next shiny gadget. It really isn't. It's about the transformation that it's bringing to our world. And if you're somebody like Derek, who called us from Holland, who wants to be a programmer, wants to work in programming, he's 15 years old. Derek, this is your opportunity for your generation to use these tools, not to make the next Farmville, but to think about ways that you can keep people communicating, open the lines of communication, and promote the notion of freedom and of democracy. I think that this is a real opportunity for your generation, Derek. So don't forget, it's fun. It's cool. It's great to frag your friends and call of duty. But there's a deeper meaning to all of this and a deeper potential. And I think if your generation can live up to it, I have very high hopes for the future of the world. Don in Dana Point, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have two specific questions and a gotcha heads up for Android users.
All right.
Number one, I'd like to find out about an Android app, which is the equivalent of Squarespace, an Android app maker, I should say. I want to create one, and there's a number of various ones listed under Google, but I don't know how to separate out the wheat from the chaff.
Google actually makes the best one, and it's free. So that's where I would start. You know, Google, of course, makes it as easy as they can because they realize, as does every company that manufactures smartphones or smartphone operating systems, that the key to all of this is making it easy for people to write software. You know, there are actually now almost as many Android apps as there are iPhone apps, and that's going to grow faster and faster.
Because when I found out to do an iPhone, I have to have a Mac, and I have to have an iPhone and a Touch, and be a member of their developers club for
$99. That's right.
Yeah, that's a deal breaker.
Meanwhile, Google makes it free. It runs on Mac, Windows, and Linux. It's very easy to do, and they have, of course, the full developer kit is available, the what they call the Android SDK, the software development kit. But they also make a very simple, easy way to do Android apps, the name of which has escaped me for the moment. I'm looking on their...
Easy is good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a point-and-click way to do it. Now, I have, you know, this is the full developer system is very powerful, and maybe somewhere you'd like to go in the future, but there is a very simple... what's the name of that, folks? The Easy Android. It's called App Inventor. Thank you, chat room, once again, to the rescue. App Inventor. It's free, and it's very fun. I mean, it's appinventor.googlelabs.com. And now you're not going to be able to create a super powerful app with all sorts of bells and whistles, but you are going to be able to create a standalone app that you can sell in the app store that you can give to people. That's pretty sophisticated.
Okay. All right. Second question. I have a powerful desktop I use for Photoshop and Lightroom, and I need a traveling laptop when I take travel and wildlife photography while I'm on the road. And it needs to have two physical hard drives because of Photoshop, so I'd have one for the scratch drive. Do you have any suggestions for a Windows unit along those lines?
I do not. I don't know of any Windows systems that have two hard drives in them. You can use Photoshop with a single drive.
Yeah, Costco had one. At the beginning of this year, they offered to have two physical hard drives, but it sold out in a flash. And I know I can order them.
I would not. To be honest, I would not get a laptop with two hard drives. I would get a single hard drive laptop, but make sure that that laptop has either USB 3.0 or FireWire interface so you can connect a fast external drive and use that. Why external? Because, first of all, if it's fast enough, it'll be just like an internal, and you can separate it. You can have one in your luggage and one in your hand carry-on because you've got a lot of precious photos on there. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. In fact, I usually carry a laptop plus two external drives, and I make exact duplicates on each drive of my day's photos so that I have a backup of my backup. I have three copies with me at all times. You might even want to upload, if you've got internet access, upload at the same time.
Okay, and the third one, I'm going to turn this over to my wife because she has a gotcha for Android she ran into.
Here. All right, actually, hang on. Okay. What's your name?
Virginia.
Virginia, go ahead and ask your question.
My question or comment is, a few months ago, maybe last fall, I bought a Droid Fantastic, and they tried to migrate my contacts from my BlackBerry on AT&T to the Droid on Verizon. When they did that, 90% of the information on my contacts from the AT&T BlackBerry were deleted. They were cut. There was not enough room in the Android to hold the contacts.
How many did you have?
Well, I'm talking on individual contacts. And if I had information on the contact, like family birthdays or gifts we gave them last, or how to get to their house so I don't have to look it up again on a map or a GPS, or contacts regarding contracts for work. And what did we say?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, if they don't have fields on the Android contact manager that match these, you know, BlackBerry fields, of course you can't back it up because there's nowhere to stick it. So this is not the way to do this. What you should do, and I presume you've been doing this, you've been using the BlackBerry desktop, so you have all that data on the BlackBerry desktop. I hope you didn't lose data. What you're going to have to do with something like this is kind of manually, use, and I would recommend anybody who's using Android or iPhone or any smartphone, get this into Google Contacts. You can add fields in Google Contacts, so you will be able to, but you might have to do some manual tweaking. Make sure it looks good in Google Contacts from the BlackBerry data, and then you could sync it to the phone just by logging into your Google account. You don't need to use any automatic transfer. So while it's, I think how it used to be, you'd get a new phone and the guys would say, oh, good, I'll take your numbers off the old phone, put it on the new phone. That's not the new way of thinking about it. If you're using a Google phone particularly, but any smartphone these days, Google in the cloud, that's your storage. That's where you want to put your stuff. The phone will sync to it automatically. Hey, thanks for your calls. Thanks for being here. Have a great Independence Day. Leo Laporte, The Tech.